Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And here I am, and I am the conscience of psychiatry. And as a part of being the conscience of psychiatry, April 13th through 15th, coming up soon in Syracuse, New York, my wife Ginger and I are presenting a fabulous conference. 2.5 days, starts on Friday morning, April 13th, goes through Sunday at noon. Going to start out with myself doing an hour presentation, and then a marvelous man, Jerry Porter, who helps direct a school of psychology, and he's going to talk about the promise of empathic therapy. I'm going to have a panel on the problems associated with antipsychotic drugs, in particular focusing on tardive dyskinesia, and we're going to have a lawyer, myself and other people. We're going to talk about involuntary treatment in another session. We're going to have people talking about psychotherapy, new and better approaches. A nurse is going to be talking about that. We'll be talking about empathic therapy in multicultural settings. A marvelous presentation that I'm especially looking forward to in the afternoon on Friday is called Empathy as Elixir, an integrated biosocial model for well-being in late life. Well, actually, beyond all of that, my friend Catherine Duthet is going to be really talking about helping elderly people, often women with dementia, with empathy, even people with dementia, empathy rather than drugs. Then at 8 p.m., my wife's favorite part, the chocolate fountain, where you come and meet the authors and meet each other and visit together. It's really the chocolate fountain in our 2 years has already become a wonderful tradition. Saturday morning, and I'm almost done just giving you a brief intro. Saturday morning, we're going to start with a panel that my guest, Matthew Downing, will be a part of, talking about the antidepressant drugs and the tragedies associated with psychiatric drugs, violence, suicide, crime. And it's going to include a number of people, including a young man who went to jail for a number of years for a series of bizarre crimes. My contribution was to at least help cut down on how long he went away for. And at 11 a.m., we're going to have Fred Bauman, a neurologist from the U.S., and Martin Whiteley from Australia, and he's a parliamentarian from Western Australia, talking about ADHD. And Martin Whiteley, as a result of his work in Australia, he lives in the only province in the world or state in the world where there's less medicating of children now than there was a few years ago. And he's going to talk about how he's done that, as well as many other accomplishments. And then from noon to one, any of you who have seen Generation X, it's the best film made critical of psychiatry. Well, the marvelous filmmaker Kevin Miller is going to be talking about his film and about his new projects. And we're just going to have all sorts of things. Another really good one is going to be dealing with grief and trauma by Joanne Cacciatore, who is probably the world's best known person in terms of the theory of grief and how to help people overcome grief and trauma. I'm going to do an evening on Saturday evening with one of the most awarded psychologists in America, Bert Caron. He's about my age, maybe a little younger. And Bert and I are going to talk about, after giving free dessert, you pay for it through your membership, through your through coming to the conference. Conferences, look it up on empathictherapy.org. the conference is not expensive. We've really cut down on prices, and it's under $300, and it includes a lot of meal. It's a wonderful hotel. But I was saying on the Saturday evening, you're going to just hear me and Bert Caron talk about psychology and psychoanalysis and psychotherapy and counseling over the generations and in the future. I'm actually looking forward to it. It's going to be very interesting. Now, we're not going to do Monday open mic as we've done for a few Mondays. I've gotten feedback, very positive feedback, about how much better people enjoy my interview shows with my marvelous guests. And so we're not going to be doing open mic Mondays. You're welcome to call in if you have a question that is spot on for today's interview as we go along. My guest, and Matthew, are you there and well connected to me?
I'm here, Peter. I've been here for about 10 minutes, just very
good,
interesting.
Good. Yeah, I was told that. I just want to make sure I could hear your voice.
I'm here.
All right. Well, that's Matthew Downing. Matthew is a drug safety advocate. We can tell you later how to get to her website. She's the wife, and she's a mother of two daughters, and her daughter Candace committed suicide as a child at the age of 12 from the effects of Zoloft. And I know this to be true because I was a medical expert in her case, which was settled. I don't believe, as always, that any guilt was admitted by anybody, but they settled for a satisfactory, I gather, amount of money.
It's never satisfactory. Never.
Well put, Matthew. Matthew, why don't you just now go on with that? That's right, it's never satisfactory. But why don't you go on with that theme?
Well, I appreciate very much being part of this significant organization, Empathic Therapy. I'm very proud of the fact that you asked me to be part of the advisory council. I know we spoke at length. I do not consider myself a victim, although losing a child is the worst thing that could possibly happen. And I've done more than survive. I wanted to move forward in a very positive way so that I could help prevent this from happening to other families. Candace's death occurred over 8 years ago, and it's unbelievable to me that people still reach out and ask for my help, my understanding, my ability just to listen. I also have a lot of people that call me, and they don't always give me their names, or they'll only give me a first name to tell me that because of hearing Candace's story, that they have chosen not to put their children on drugs, or they have very carefully, under the help of a physician, removed their child from medication. That, to me, is one of the greatest honors, to know that people take what I say with sincerity. They take it to heart. They learn from what we did not know and move forward in more positive ways, which really benefit their children. There are so many other outlets in helping a child survive and get through difficult times, and it's so discouraging to me that doctors, pediatricians, even physicians' assistants are so anxious to medicate children without ever looking at the etiology. And from every story I've heard from every single family, there's always an etiology. There's always some underlying reason that children are behaving in ways that are considered inappropriate. And I've learned so much. You know, I regret the fact that my daughter was a stepping stone for improvements that have been made, but at the same time, I'm very proud of the fact that even in death, my daughter is encouraging others in ways that I never knew possible, and that positive change is occurring, although we're not there yet, Peter. We're really not there.
No, we're far, far away from the public really realizing how much more harm than good the drugs do at all age levels, in my opinion. And, of course, the profession responds to every criticism by getting more drug company money to push harder the drugs on the public. But I think we are making some progress. And I'm, of course, delighted that you do work with us and that you're on our advisory council and you'll be at our conference just in a couple of weeks. Going to be good to see you. Do you want to talk a little about how your daughter got into this situation, or more accurately, how you got into this situation of her being prescribed medication, Zoloft in this case?
Yes, I am not a proponent. I am not a believer in drugging children. I never was, and I questioned it when my daughter was put on medication. Candace was an honor student, an athlete. She was a friend to everybody. She was one of those kids that just really had it all. She came from a very functional, happy family. She went to an outstanding school. But Candace had test anxiety, and the anxieties kept increasing. And as a parent, I was very concerned. When I talked to her pediatrician, they did not believe in medicating children and said, but if you're concerned, then we suggest you speak to a child psychiatrist. Within 10 minutes of my speaking to a child psychiatrist, Candace was placed on a sample pack of Zoloft. There was no warning on the packet. I had read the brochure about Zoloft in the doctor's office. There was no warning. I was familiar with the happy blob bouncing across the television screen several times a day. Again, no warning. So it alleviated some of my fear, but I was never really comfortable with it. And after she had been on the medication, and I need to insert and say that when he told me, when the psychiatrist said, okay, she has a generalized anxiety disorder, put her on Zoloft, there really weren't other options. I took it upon myself to speak to the school. We got all of the teachers and administrators together and discussed what her anxiety was, and it did come across solely as test anxiety, but it was her diagnosis was a generalized anxiety disorder that only manifested itself at school. The teachers formed a team right away and looked at ways to make accommodations to help alleviate Candace's stress. She was given different options as ways to take tests rather than just writing. She was provided a laptop so that she could type. Her typing skills were great, but her writing skills, being a clumsy left-hander, were horrible. And sometimes she got things right on tests that the teacher marked wrong because she considered them illegible. She was allowed to draw her answers for science because she was a wonderful artist. She was allowed to take her tests in small group or to take them individually with teachers. So we put everything in place that we possibly could. I was a little wary of the preservatives in food, so she had a very natural diet. We watched at what time she ate. But even with all that in place, the psychiatrist decided at the end of summer, when she would be going into seventh grade, that he needed to double her dosage. I know from looking at medical records, Candace was not able to metabolize this medication. And again, no blood work was done to see whether or not that she could tolerate this drug. I didn't even know about blood work at the time. There are tests that can be done to see how well a child can take the drug without having a violent reaction. The psychiatrist.
Yeah, let me explain that just for a minute. That the liver has enzymes or chemicals that metabolize or break down the most psychiatric drugs, not all, but most psychiatric drugs. And there's a variety of enzymes that affect different drugs, and a number of drugs are affected by the same enzyme. But what's key is that many people, up to 10%, may lack the enzyme or the full enzyme for metabolizing a drug like Zoloft. So instead of it's being broken down by the liver and then removed from the body, it stays longer and in higher doses. And so you may think you're getting 20 milligrams or 50, but you may be getting 100 in effect because the drug isn't being removed from the body. And there are tests for the liver enzymes. There are labs you can send blood to and find out how the liver enzymes are. But the drug companies have not pushed this, not encouraged this, and so the labs remain obscure and unknown to most people, and the test remains obscure and unknown and very expensive. And certainly one of the things that the drug companies, if they were more honorable, would do would be to develop a cheap and readily available test that would be given to everybody before they ever took the various psychiatric drugs.
So, and again,
go ahead. I just wanted to
my,
give a little
right, but with my being naive, I was not aware of this until after Candace's death. The other problem we had is the psychiatrist told Candace, well, look, if you ever get nervous the night before a test, just basically pop another pill and you'll be fine and it will help you, you know, help you sleep through the night. We know in retrospect that was a horrible thing to tell her. And what happened was here this drug was building up in her body. She was not getting relief from it. In fact, according to two of our experts, she was having to fight off the symptoms of the Zoloft at the same time all appropriate accommodations were in place. We weren't told about any symptoms to look for. When I look back, I remember Candace having prickly feelings in her skin. I can remember her eyes dilating. I can remember a tick that was developing in her left hand, but we didn't know these were symptomatic. We didn't know what was causing this. I thought the hand tremor was just nervousness. And it's so upsetting to me that this was hidden, just like you talked about the drug test. We just didn't know. Well, what happened was Candace was going to have a test in January. It was January 4th. She'd had a great day. She'd played with friends. And while I was in the shower, she took the extra pill the way the doctor told her she could. And she had a severe reaction to the pill to the point I called the pediatrician and said, what do I do? She's shaking. She's talking loud. She's acting paranoid. And they told me to call poison control, which I did. And poison control said, take her to the hospital. She became very nauseous from this one pill, and by the time we got to the emergency room, she vomited on the floor, the one pill that she had taken. They admitted her to the pediatric ER and immediately gave her Versed to try and calm her down. Well, the Versed just created this horrific situation where she began hallucinating. Her blood pressure went up. Her heart rate increased.
Let me just occasionally break in and add a little embellishment. Versed is a very commonly used drug for anesthesia, for knocking out somebody so you can operate on them. It's a benzo. It's very strong. It should never be used to calm anybody down in an emergency room. And in this youngster's case, it was certainly ridiculous to use yet another toxic drug. But the giving of the Versed was, in my opinion, very improper. And Versed has a terrible history of people awakening out of the anesthesia in a very disturbed state. It's probably does that more in withdrawal than almost any other drug we know of. So, again, a bad decision on the part of those giving medical care.
And it was also given as a double dose. Here she weighed 67 pounds, and they gave her the adult treatment. It was not given correctly. It was not titrated through a saline solution. It was injected straight into her vein, and the change was immediate. And then because she did so poorly on that, they turned around and gave her Ativan on top of it, which just destroyed her farther. And
Ativan, again, being yet another benzodiazepine, so she's getting all these drugs that are going to suppress her central nervous system, which is already impaired by the Zoloft, and just send her off in further into Never Never Land.
Right. So she, instead of just being monitored, as poison control told me would happen, she ended up in pediatric intensive care. And under 24-hour watch, which no one explained to me. And it was only through the medical records that we found out what happened, actually enlarged the left ventricle of her heart. She never really slept again. She never really ate again. and she remained in the hospital. She started having severe headaches. So she was admitted on a Sunday, and on Tuesday they gave her 100 milligrams of Zoloft. And since I never left my child's side, I actually witnessed this, questioned it, was told that it was Tylenol, not Zoloft, but I did not believe them and checked with the hospital at a later date after Candace had died because I saw the color of the pills, which was 50 milligram pills of Zoloft and not Tylenol, and had the pharmacist at the hospital tell me that Tylenol was always white that they gave the children, and I had witnessed Candace being given these two blue pills, which were in fact two 50 milligram tablets of Zoloft, and then she was sent home the next day.
Now, as I recall, when I went through the medical record, you went through the medical record, we actually found a place that had been ordered.
Yes. Yes.
They were giving a child.
And in the medical billing, we also were billed for the two pills that I witnessed them giving her.
Yeah. You know, there is something that we need to address that seems to be very generic in psychiatric treatment, which is denial is so great in regard to psychiatric drug-induced disorders that one of the first things that psychiatrists tend to do when a patient has an adverse reaction to a drug is to give them more of it. It kind of reminds me of the man who beats his wife and someone calls his attention to it, and he basically says, if you think that was a beating, wait till I get home and give you a bigger one. It's a reaction of the abuser. It's the only way I've been able to psychologically understand it. It is not anywhere near the only case of this. And it's now what your daughter was suffering from, I don't think you've mentioned yet, was serotonin syndrome. She was toxic on drugs that stimulate serotonin, in this case Zoloft. All of the antidepressants, the newer ones that are called SSRIs, they're called that. They're selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. They block the removal of serotonin from the active place in the synapse. Now, usually that results in a very unstable and confusing imbalance, but in some cases it simply jacks up the serotonin system, and that can be a disaster, even though it's supposed to be good for the person. And the symptoms include hallucinations and all kinds
agitation.
Of abnormal states and confusion and elevated heart rate, or blood pressure can go up. There's often a lot of abnormal movements, and especially a hyperactivity. And this is not the only case where I've seen a person with serotonin syndrome, other legal cases, given more of the same kind of drug. So,
in fact, Dr. Bragan, I worked with a family out in Wyoming who had a daughter. She had broken up with her boyfriend, was feeling very sad about it, and they put her on Zoloft because she had broken up with a boyfriend. Oh, you're sad. Let's give you Zoloft. She did not respond well, and just as you're saying, instead of taking her off the medication, they just kept increasing it and increasing it until she was finally on 600 milligrams a day. During the time that they kept increasing it, she attempted suicide three times, was hospitalized at least twice, and in the end, within the year, she did end up killing herself. She hanged herself while on 600 milligrams of Zoloft. So it's exactly what you're saying.
600 sounds impossible, Nathy. Are you sure of that?
Yes.
I don't think so. Maybe 60?
No. They just kept increasing it and increasing. That's what the mother told me. I spoke with the mother for quite a while about it.
Just bizarre.
It was bizarre. And so Candace ended up, she was given the 100 milligrams of Zoloft on Tuesday. On Wednesday was sent home in the evening. She acted like she had flu symptoms. She was exhausted. She still hadn't slept. She still wasn't eating. She stayed at home on Thursday, just because she was so tired, but on Friday went to school, had a beautiful day at school. She took a test. She did well on it. Everyone was so happy to see her. But the one thing that was noted, which, again, we did not learn until after her death, was she was hallucinating at school. She thought there were bugs on her hand and on her pencil. And one of the kids noticed and said, "Candace, what are you doing?" And she said, "I can't get the bugs off." And her friend said, "Candace, there aren't any bugs there." And she looked at her hand and she said, "Oh, you're right," and just kind of giggled. And nothing more was said. But the other problem was Candace couldn't see. She had to have her seat moved to the very front of the class because she didn't have her vision back. This was not a child that wore glasses, but her vision never was back to normal.
Let me just add that seeing small objects and seeing bugs is practically diagnostic of drug intoxication. Very few other things cause hallucinations of little bugs crawling around on the skin or on the walls. It's remotely possible that it could occur from something else, but any doctor should know that's a drug intoxication. So go ahead, Matthew, we're going to have about 3 or 4 more minutes before break. So go ahead and then tell us a little more. Then we'll go to break. And when we come back, I want to talk about the positive reform work you're doing some more,
great.
If that's okay with you.
But yeah, that's fine.
See if you can tie this story up right now.
Okay. I did take Candace to see her psychiatrist on Friday. We talked about what had happened in the hospital. He was very disturbed about the medications they'd given her. He told me, "I don't want her on any medication." So here's a child that had been taking something consistently and then overdosed on something. And then he said, "No more drugs. She's great. I want you to come back in 2 weeks." And within 24 hours, with absolutely no idea at all, Candace hanged herself in her bedroom with both her father and sister sitting right downstairs. Absolutely no awareness of her actions. And her pediatrician told me I needed to be comforted by the fact she had no awareness of what she had done.
It's so devastating. And on autopsy, indeed, she had a high blood level of Zoloft, confirming that they had overdosed her in the hospital. It was the only way she could have continued to have it in her system. A tragedy, it's got a lot of elements. It's got the bad medical practice in the emergency room. It's got bad medical practice in the hospital. But I also want to affirm that children and adults do kill themselves when it's ordinary medical practice, just 50 milligrams of Zoloft, you know, a typical starting dose, with no other botching up by the medical profession, can easily cause a suicide. In this case, we had a series of mishaps involved. Everybody who goes to a hospital, you really need an ombudsman with you. You really need somebody with you watching over. But as Matthew's case, even having a really intelligent mother on top of it, it's hard to figure out what's being done until afterward. And sometimes they won't tell you or they'll misrepresent what's being done. But hospitals can be very dangerous places. My focus, of course, though, is on that these drugs in themselves, without any mistakes being made other than giving a drug to a kid, can be lethal for children and adults.
And I have to tell you, Dr. Bragan, that my husband and I both asked what the doctors were doing at the hospital. And on 2 different occasions, we were told they had no idea what they were doing. They were calling poison control and that they were totally out of their league on this one. But at no time did they ever consider sending her to a hospital where they would have known what to do.
Thank you. Can you give us just quickly your how to contact you? Well, you know what? Let's wait for that when we come back. We've been talking to Matthew Downing, a wonderful woman, a wonderful reformer. And we'll go to break now and come back and talk some more about her reform work.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. And I am the conscience of psychiatry. And if you've doubted that, you can tell from this show that I do indeed have that function. One of the things in my own work that I'm very proud of is that I actually did write, along with my wife Ginger, the first book that really took on this issue of suicide and violence caused by the SSRIs. And that was our very big best-selling book, Talking Back to Prozac. And at the time, the FDA, 10 years later, finally got around to changing the labels and upgrading the labels to include suicide as a risk in a black box warning, eventually for children, youth, and young adults. The FDA also put throughout the label for these drugs a series of warnings which indicates that for any age, these drugs can worsen your condition, make you very disturbed, and eventually cause suicidal or homicidal kinds of behavior. And they use words like aggression and hostility. And I'm very proud of that. At the hearings that were conducted by the FDA, where its panel met and then met with the public about these issues, the FDA actually distributed one of my scientific articles to every member of the panel. And the basic concept of the string of events of these drugs causing irritability and anxiety and insomnia and aggression and hostility and hypomania and mania is practically taken verbatim from my work. So I'm very proud of my own work in this area, but we've hardly slowed them down at all, except perhaps a little bit in regard to children. Matthew, I have two questions. First, how do people get in touch with you?
My email is Matthew, Matthy02@AOL.com. I do not have a direct website about Candace, although I'm in the process of developing one because I'm asked so frequently about my website. So that is in the works, and I plan to have connections to a lot of the other sites that have really helped me with listings for different documentaries and papers and things that have really, a list of books like your books. You mentioned Kevin Miller's Generation RX, and you and I both know we're both prominent in that documentary. They did a documentary called Prescription Suicide that Robert Manciero did with Full Visions, and that's basically the story of six American families that have gone through this, which is actually narrated by my surviving daughter, and it did a lot to help her come to some kind of closure and understanding about what had happened.
Where can people get that film, that video?
On Amazon.com. And again,
give the name again of it, please.
It is Prescription Suicide.
And also give your email again. I think that was your email you gave, right?
Yes, Matthy02@AOL.com. Matthy02@AOL.com. And I have to tell you, I hear from people all over the United States every day. So I do respond to any comments or any questions that people ask me. And Dr. Bregan, you know as a matter of fact that if there's something I can't answer, I contact you right away.
Matthew, you were at our conference last year, and again, we really hope folks will come. If you want to know what can you do to support the movement and to learn as much as you can and to feel involved and to meet marvelous people and to feel inspired, I guarantee it won't be a downer for you. It's inspiring.
Well,
go to empathictherapy.org. empathictherapy.org, and come to our April 13th through 15th conference in Syracuse. Matthew, can you talk a little bit about your experience of what our conference was like last year?
I did. I wrote down several things. It was excellent. It was very well attended. For being the first initial conference of empathic therapy, There were well over 200 people. What impressed me, Dr. Bragan, was how many people from around the world attended this conference. The other thing that I appreciated at the conference is I'm not a medical doctor. I'm a mother. I'm someone who has lost a child. I'm an advocate. And I felt very much a part of the conference. I wasn't intimidated by the fact that I was not a psychiatrist or psychologist. I am well-educated. I do have a master's in counseling. But I was so impressed by the caliber of professionals that attended this meeting, as well as other victims of what had happened who also chose to become advocates and not remain victims. And they're moving forward and were anxious to share their story and the way that they're trying to work and process through what's happened to them. It was really exciting. It was very diverse. And I definitely would not miss one of these conferences again. I really enjoyed myself. I always go away having learned something. Professional materials are available. It's a significant conference. It's not just a good conference. It's significant in moving forward in promoting better mental health.
Thank you. Thank you, Matthew. Would you like to talk more about your reform work? I want you to have the opportunity to just talk about what you're doing.
Okay, well, I have to say that we as a family got into this early. Candace had only passed away 3 weeks prior to when we attended our first FDA hearing. And I actually found out about the hearing not through anything in our local paper. It was through the mother of a friend of mine that lived in Florida, because it was Florida news that talked about the FDA hearings about the danger of SSRIs. We had a terrible time trying to get anyone at the FDA to tell us anything about it. And when we finally were told something by someone at the FDA, they told us the wrong place. So we went to one hotel looking for the hearings, and there was nothing there. Luckily, this hotel said, please come into our business office, go through the archives of the FDA, and we found out where it was. So imagine how we felt, having no idea how this could have happened to our darling little girl, who was just so happy in the light of our lives, to sit through 8 hours of people crying, just devastated because the same thing had happened to them. So that was our first connection, our first realization, hey, we're not in this alone. This is happening to a lot of people all over the United States, all over the world, in fact. And it made me want to become involved, that if these people could move forward, if these people could stand up there and tell the FDA what had happened to them, I wanted to be a part of that too. So at the hearings I had on September 13th in 2004, the same year Candace died, I was one of those people that stood up and spoke. The FDA did not want me to speak and made me speaker number 71, although I should have been about number 2. Because they didn't want the press there when I spoke. Unbeknownst to them, there was still a New York Times reporter there and local networks that were there. And I spoke, and I was asked after that to be on the Today Show to speak more about what had happened with Candace. And I firmly believe that looking at Candace's case, we were one of the cases the FDA looked into before they made that decision in October to put a black box warning on. I was called the day of the black box warning going into effect by CNN and told, you have to come to Washington. We want to interview you about the story, because Candace's story was so pure. This was not a child who was suicidal. This was not a child who had such dark angst that she could barely survive. This was a child so full of light and so loved and so happy that I think that is a reason her story has continued to be important, because you can't say anything other than it was the medication.
That's why they settled, one of the reasons, but most of these cases get settled. Now, where did we meet? Did we meet at the first FDA conference? I always get very vague in my looking back on my life on when I met important people.
You know what? I'm sorry, but I mean, it's the same thing. I have done so much with this.
Yeah, I
can't really tell you. I do know that when you were still associated with ICSPP, that the person that did our documentary was invited as a keynote speaker, and I went with him. I was so impressed with the organization I joined because, again, you founded this organization, and I thought the works that they were doing was phenomenal. So I do know that's how I became more involved in those organizations, but I also started advocating on Capitol Hill. I gave written and oral testimony to senators and congressmen, and I joined other entities that were working in teams to go in and speak, and just really became involved. And it got to the point when I was on the Hill and I would go to a senator's office, they would say, "Oh, we know who you are." And I'd say, "You do?" And they would see the written testimony that I had about Candace, which always included colored pictures of her. And I would see these men, these grown men, break down and cry. And they would say, "You know, I'm a father too." And it would just be devastating. And I feel like it did touch them. I became a safety advocate for Consumers Union Consumer Reports. And James Guest, president of Consumer Reports, testified on the Senate floor about Candace personally. So I got out there and I told my story to anyone I could get to listen because it's a story that needs to be told. It's a warning that has to be out there, and she's a perfect example of it. I've picketed the White House. I mean, I've been out there. And if you were to go to SSRI Stories, there's over 3,000 stories. Candace is just one of those stories. So if people think this isn't happening, they need to wake up and smell the coffee.
When people ask me, what can I do? You know, what can I as one person do? You're an inspiration for that. And I think I should just send folks who ask me that question to you.
Well, it's fine.
You're
I
just
like
a living example of what one person can do. And, of course, I've tried to be that in my own field, too. There's so much one person can do. Never be dismayed that you're alone in a reform arena. And if there's an area you're interested in, like the one that Matthew and I work in, of psychiatric reform or psychiatric drug reform or electroshock reform or whatever your area that you're interested in, involuntary treatment, stopping that. There's so much you as an individual can do both on your own and by getting in touch with people who are doing it and joining organizations. And, of course, since we're getting down to the wire, I'm reminding you about my conference, our conference. Come to our conference April 13th to 15th in Syracuse, empathictherapy.org. Matthew, do you think that doing this reform work has, I know you've talked about it being a good thing for your daughter. Has it been a good thing for your family?
It really has been. I think that in the past, if something did happen to a child, they were quick to just hide it. You know, well, there must have been some reason for the suicide, and we didn't know about it, and they didn't talk about it. What I'm finding is people are more willing to talk. And when I hear a story about a child taking their life, especially at a very early age, my first question is also, were they on antidepressants? And I want to tell you, 100% of the time they were. It also helps to have a friend like you, Peter. I'll just admit it, because you know for a fact that I have been asked questions I have not been able to answer, and I've gone directly to you. I would not encourage people to talk or do something where they weren't informed. If there's a question asked of you, go to someone that does know the answer. You were very instrumental in helping me get a student off medication last year in a very safe way. I am a teacher. I've been a teacher for almost 3 decades. And I recognize the signs of drug inhibitions, I mean drug issues with this one little girl that was in my class who was 7 years old. They had never looked into the etiology of why this child was having emotional problems. They just drugged her. By my working with the daughter and the mom, I found out the child was an only child who'd witnessed severe violence between her parents, who ended up having a horrible divorce. And they couldn't understand why she talked at school. She had no one to talk to. They couldn't understand why she was having sleeping problems. She was terrified. And by working with the parents and then talking with you, we very safely got this child off the cocktail of medications they put her on, never working with what the cause of her problems was. So I'm very quick to say, if there's something you don't know, find a source that can help you. And, you know, that's been important to me. Find someone you can rely on, like I rely on Dr. Bragan, to answer questions that I do not feel qualified to answer.
But tell us some more about how the reform work has affected you, because it's really important, I think, for people to know that standing up for the truth and speaking truth to authority, because I'm sure you've taken some lumps along the way, is overall just a very positive thing to do in life. Have you taken lumps along the way?
There was, honestly, I have found this so rewarding and so positive. In the 8 years that I have worked against people having a deeper understanding to the problems of the SSRIs, I have had one article written where my words were taken, totally misconstrued, where half of a statement that I made was written and the other half left off, so that the article portrayed me as some sickened, dead person who could never get past the death of my daughter. There was no focus on anything that I had done in a positive light. Even the picture of me that they took, they did with a dark print so that I would look morose and depressed and unable to move forward. I was devastated. I even talked to a lawyer about it. It was the most devastating thing that could have happened to me. Also going through depositions with a company as evil as Pfizer, their intent was to crush us as a family, and they even stated following our depositions that they had not been prepared for a family that was so strong and so united, and we had the truth on our side. There was nothing that we had to change about what had happened because we spoke the truth, and we never changed one thing we said. Pfizer wasn't prepared for that. They're so willing to intimidate people, and we could not be intimidated. So I think I've gained strength from this. I'm not afraid. They've taken the worst possible thing they can take from me. What do I have to fear? They've already done the worst thing they could possibly do to me. So there's a strength in not being afraid. There's a strength in knowing the truth and being able to go forward with the truth to help others. And that's what I'm doing. Do I feel like I'm more powerful, that I'm more prepared? Absolutely. Do I regret it was my child that died? Absolutely. But in her death, I have been able to move forward to help others. And to have people call me and say, your child saved my child's life. I knew what to look for, and I did not choose to put my child on drugs. Even a new colleague that I have came to me and said when my son was 5 years old, they wanted to put him on antidepressants. But I didn't even know you, but I read the story about your daughter, and I said, absolutely not. And it was a real strong point between she and her husband because her husband wanted to medicate. And the mother stood strong and said, I'm not doing it. Look at what happened to this little girl, not even knowing me until 8 years later. So
that's just wonderful, Matthew. And how is your older daughter doing, who is involved in, she's still involved in the reform work?
Yes, she is. And what was wonderful was that Caroline, my surviving daughter, who was only 14 when Candace died, went into art therapy. There are so many options of things you can do. Now, the school said, well, your daughter's having focusing problems. She's ADD or ADHD, and we want her tested and basically medicated. And then I said, I'll be damned if you medicate this daughter. I've already lost one to medications. It's not going to happen. But I agreed to have the testing done. It showed that Caroline was extremely bright, that she had no history of focusing problems until her sister died. So it was exactly what I told them it would be. She remained in art therapy for the second half of her freshman year and her sophomore year. By her junior year, she was back on honors, as both my girls had always been, graduated not only with honors but as a class speaker, and went on to attend college, graduated from that program with honors, and is now a graduate student in a very elite program at George Washington University in documentary filmmaking, because that helped shape the course of her life in such a positive way that she wants to be able to give back. So she has also spoken out. She's taken the film Prescription Suicide. She's had showings of it at her school. She's given a copy to George Washington University, and she also is not afraid to stand up for what is right. So, yes, my daughter has also become an advocate in her own right, and it's a wonderful thing, and she's whole. My daughter is one of my best victories. Caroline is completely whole and happy and healthy, never losing sight of having lost her sister. And she also has personally helped friends in college get off these medications, and it turned out that while she was at school, kids would come to her to talk about it, and at least two that I can think of were able to completely get off the medication and are much healthier and happier because of it.
Well, it's wonderful how well you're doing, all of you. And again, folks, you can make a difference. All of us as individuals have a tremendous ability to think for ourselves and create for ourselves and to make a difference. And, of course, it doesn't have to be in psychiatric reform, for goodness sakes. It can be in any area that's dear to your heart. You can make a difference in our society. We're still free enough. There's still enough access to the media. And in particular, with the Internet, there's still enough ability for us to communicate with each other and with the world and to do a great deal that's useful for people. And I think, Matthew, you actually have been a lot in touch, even more than with me, with my wife Ginger, who is the outreach of my life and the outreach of my program.
Well,
and
I love you
both. You were saying so
both,
much about
so.
Me that I want to mention that, of course, you and Ginger became quite much in good touch and caring about each other through all this.
Well, I care about both of you so much, and you have helped me in so many situations. And it's, you know, we're all a package deal. We're all fighting a good fight, and the more we can work together, the better it is. But I'm indebted for you, not only what you did for us as a family, but also for your help in answering questions for me when I didn't know the answer. And it's just tremendous to me that I have the kind of professional support that I need when it's something I don't know enough about. So, and yes, Ginger and I do stay in touch, and I love her dearly.
Yes. I don't want to take so much credit that you're giving me, because I think a lot of it is, well, a lot of it's just generous, and a lot of it is also Ginger's involvement, because she just gives a lot. Matthew Downing, one more time, how can people get in touch with you?
I can be reached at Matthew, Matthy02@AOL.com, and I look forward to hearing anyone, whether it's to share a story, whether it's to ask a question. I'm there, and I have people get in touch with me from all over the world. I have a person in New Zealand who is coming to stay with me in May. She, devastating story. She was a single parent with one child who, again, was placed on an antidepressant because of a breakup with a girl. Did not respond well. They continued to add more and more medication, and he hanged himself.
Matthew, I'm going to have to interrupt in the middle of,
okay.
of your finishing that. We've got about, I think, 30 seconds left. I want to thank you for all that you do, for your service. You're like a soldier. Maybe
well,
a general.
You.
So I thank you for your service. Folks, you can come meet Matthew Downing. You can meet her, talk to her, and meet maybe a couple of hundred other wonderful people. April 13th through 15th, go to empathictherapy.org, or you can get to it through my website, Bregan.com. And if you want to learn more about these issues, my book, Medication Madness, tells Matthew's story. My book, Medication Madness, tells dozens of stories of people injured by psychiatric drugs who became violent, suicidal, or committed dreadful crimes or otherwise wasted their lives. Medication Madness. Thanks for listening, and I will be with you in a week again.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bregan and his lifelong reform work on www.bregan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.